wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited her son on Monday, the biggest prize his troops have won so far, and vowed to press on recapturing all occupied lands. Zelensky addressed troops in front of the administration building in the main square where residents had turned out, some with children, some waving Ukrainian flags or draped in them. He then commemorated fallen soldiers and watched the Ukrainian flag raised over an administration building. Kherson was one of the four provinces that Russian President Vladimir Putin declared annexed last month and said would be part of Russia forever. The United Nations General Assembly on Monday called for Russia to be held accountable for its conduct in Ukraine, voting to approve a resolution recognizing that Russia must be responsible for making reparations to the country. General Assembly resolutions are non-binding, but they carry political weight. Ukrainian ambassador to the UN told the General Assembly before the vote that Russia has targeted everything from factories to residential buildings and hospitals.
Ukraine will have the daunting task of rebuilding the country and recovering from this war. But that recovery will never be complete without a sense of justice for the victims of the Russian war. It is time to hold Russia accountable.
Russia's UN ambassador told the General Assembly before the vote that the provisions of the resolution are, quote, legally null and void, and urged countries to vote against it. U.S. and Cuban officials plan to meet in Havana on Tuesday to discuss migration policy. Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen says he has COVID-19 and is leaving the Group of 20 summit in Bali, just days after hosting many world leaders, including U.S. President Joe Biden, at another gathering in Cambodia's capital. The leader says he feels normal and is returning to Cambodia. He said he was lucky he arrived in Bali late Monday and was unable to join a dinner with French President Emmanuel Macron and other leaders. Cambodia was the host of the earlier Association of Southeast Asian Nations Summit, and Hun Sen met with many leaders who attended one-on-one. Israel's defense minister says the United States government has started an investigation into the fatal shooting of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Israel is condemning the probe as a quote-unquote grave mistake and vowing not to cooperate. Palestinian officials, Abu Akleh's family, and Al Jazeera accuse Israel of intentionally targeting and killing the 51-year-old journalist, a claim Israel denies. Some threats to schools across the U.S. may be coming from overseas, AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Federal agents believe a recent spate of threats and false reports of shooters at high schools and colleges across the U.S. may be coming from outside the country, falsely reporting explosive devices being planted at the schools or saying that a shooting was imminent. Earlier this year, dozens of historically black colleges were targeted by calls or emails threatening to set off bombs on their campuses. According to an official, an investigation shows some of the threats were made by minors, and a subsequent set of threats came from callers who could be located outside of the U.S. Norman Hall, Washington.
The suspect in the deadly shooting at a university in the eastern U.S. state of Virginia has been taken into custody. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
University of Virginia Police Chief Tim Lungo was in the middle of a news conference in Charlottesville when...
We just received information the suspect is in custody.
That suspect is Christopher Darnell Jones Jr., who officials say allegedly gunned down fellow students in a bus as they returned from a school field trip. Three members of the football team have died and two other students were wounded. I'm Shelley Adler.
American comedian Jay Leno was taken to a medical burn center after his face was burned in his Los Angeles garage when one of his cars burst into flames. The left side of the former The Tonight Show's host's face was burned, but Leno's eye and ear were not severely damaged. Leno confirmed the news to Variety, saying he, quote, got some serious burns, but said he's okay, just needs a week or two to get back on his feet. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, November 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chino Dorfo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, European Union weapons and equipment assistance to Ukraine tops 8 billion euros.
It's about 45% of the effort done by the U.S., so it's not negligible. We are talking about not 3.1, but about 8 billion on military support.
The U.S. offers up to $10 million reward for information about three leaders of Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab.
The U.S. government is asking the citizens of Somalia and the region to help trace Al-Shabaab leaders Ahmed Diriye, Mahat Karate and Jihad Mustafa.
And the world population hits the 8 billion mark this week, creating new challenges for India and China. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has made a triumphant visit to the newly liberated city of Kherson. He hailed the Russian withdrawal from the southern city as the, quote, beginning of the end of the war, unquote, but also acknowledged the heavy price Ukrainian forces are paying in their grinding effort to push back the invaders. Retaking Kherson was one of Ukraine's biggest successes in the nearly nine-month-old war and delivered another stinking blow to the Kremlin. This, as European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell disclosed that the body had delivered weapons and equipment worth over 8 billion euros to Kyiv.
It's about 45% of the effort done by the U.S. So it's not negligible. We are talking about not 3.1, but about 8 billion on military support. We will continue isolating Russia internationally. We will continue imposing restrictive measures against Russian economy. We stand ready to continue reinforcing restrictive measures and target third countries' involvement, especially the ones who know that they are providing arms and military support, Iran and Belarus. Putin is unable to conquer Ukraine. Putin is unable to defeat the Ukrainian army. Putin is withdrawing. The Russian army has withdrawn to the other side of the Dnieper River and is trying to compensate this military failure with efforts to increase the human suffering of the Ukrainian people, especially now that the winter is approaching.
That's European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. British Defense Minister Ben Wallace on Sunday said the war's momentum was on Ukraine's side, following Russia's withdrawal from Kherson. To discuss the significance of Moscow's retreat from the only regional capital it captured in its war against Ukraine, VOA Steve Miller spoke with Craig Albert, the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in the southern U.S. state of Georgia.
Being able to reach the city right now, for being able to push, or Russia says they strategically pulled away from the city to regroup. Either way, the loss of that only provincial capital is huge. Russia claims that as a part of their territory now as of last month. So the fact that the way their audience is going to look at it is as Ukraine took some of Russia's territory, that could be a huge information advantage for Ukraine. It nudges that type of propaganda and sends it towards the Russian audience there that Russia lost some of its claimed land that we know is Ukraine, but the way the Russian information morph plays it is they say it's theirs now. So that's a huge defeat for Russia. So it'll be interesting to see how the state of Russia states this and whether they think that they need to reclaim their own territory and if that gives them more leeway to use more aggressive tactics, something that we should be concerned about.
You bring up that whether or not this is viewed as Ukrainians now taking Russian territory from the Russian perspective. And there's been that concern that perhaps that was one of the rationales that Putin used to annex these four regions of Ukraine that is inherently Ukrainian territory. What are some of the dangers that watchers of this ongoing conflict should be looking at should then escalation proceed?
We've already seen lots of damage to Ukrainian critical infrastructure, and so that's something that Putin could retaliate even more. He could try more massive cyber attacks. He could try, full-scale destruction of infrastructure. You know, we're thinking about those dams. There's a dam that's been mined. He could decide to blow that, try to blame it on the Ukrainians themselves. So he could create widespread chaos and havoc by completely demolishing that type of critical infrastructure. We already see reports of some downing of television and radio stations around the Kherson region. So that could escalate. But I think everybody's real concern is, you know, a complete artillery bombardment by Putin, something akin to what he did in Grozny in Chechnya.
That's Craig Albert, the graduate director of the Master of Arts in Intelligence and Security Studies at Augusta University in Georgia. He spoke with VOA Steve Miller. Turkey is claiming a breakthrough in Sunday's fatal bombing, with security forces detaining a woman suspected of planting the bomb that killed 6 people and injured other 50 others. Ankara is accusing Syrian Kurdish militants backed by the United States of ordering the attack. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
In the early hours of Monday morning in Istanbul, Turkish security forces arrested the woman suspected of planting the bomb in Sunday's attack. Turkey's Interior Minister, Süleyman Soylu, announced what authorities touted as a breakthrough.
Biraz önce olayı yapan...
Soylu said, a short while ago, the person who carried out the incident, who left the bomb, was detained by the Istanbul police. 21 other people had also been detained. Arrests are continuing, with more than 50 being held as early as Monday. Video footage of a woman appearing to leave a bag at the site of the bombing and then running away was released shortly after the attack. Turkish security forces named the suspect as Syrian national Arlan al-Bashir. They claim she had confessed to being trained by the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK. The PKK, in a statement Monday, denied involvement in the bombing, saying it doesn't target civilians. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the attack. The PKK has been fighting the Turkish state for greater Kurdish rights for more than 40 years. The militant group was linked to the bombing of an Istanbul football match in 2016, killing more than 40 people. But Soylu, the Turkish Interior Minister, claims Sunday's attack was organized in Kobani, a Syrian city controlled by the YPG, a Syrian Kurdish militia, which Ankara says is affiliated with the PKK, a charge it denies. The United States backs the YPG in its war against the Islamic State. Soylu, speaking at the site of the Istanbul bombing, says that Turkey needs to reconsider its ties with its American ally following Sunday's attack.
American Büyükelçiliğin taziye dilemesini kabul etmiyoruz, reddediyoruz.
Soylu said Turkey rejects the condolences of the American embassy. Turkey, he said, does not accept it. The Turkish official said an alliance with a state that sends money from its own Senate to these groups feeding the terror zones in Kobani, which aims to disturb Turkey's peace, is, in his words, in a controversial situation. This is open and clear, Soylu said. Washington's backing of the YPG and its political affiliate, the PYD, is poisoning relations with its Turkish ally, says international relations professor Senan Aydın Düzgit of Istanbul's Sabancı University.
You'll have the Americans' alliance with the Kurds, with PYD in particular, in northern Syria. So there is this perception that America is in alliance with the PKK and the Kurdish nationalist movement, and that sort of creates hostility as well.
The escalating diplomatic dispute between Turkey and the United States comes as shopkeepers clear the devastation of Sunday's bombing and, like the rest of the city, try to come to terms with this latest attack, as shopkeeper Lokman Kalkan explains. He said, "It's been a disaster. You see, this is all that happened. People were fighting for their lives. There is nothing we can do," he said. Details of those killed by Sunday's attack are now being released. A mother and son, a father and daughter, and a married couple. The oldest victim was 40. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
In other news, former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was set to return to power in one of the most right-wing coalitions in Israel's history, causing jitters among Palestinians and Arab neighbors who feared could ratchet up tensions across the Middle East. With roughly 85% of the votes counted, Netanyahu's conservative Likud and his likely religious and far-right allies were on pace to control a majority in parliament after Israel's 5th election in less than 4 years. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofoa in Washington. The U.S. government has announced increased rewards of up to $10 million for information that helps find three leaders of Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab. The three include the group's two top leaders and a U.S. citizen who has been part of the group for the past 14 years. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
The U.S. government is asking the citizens of Somalia and the region to help trace Al-Shabaab leaders Ahmed Diriye, Mahat Karate and Jihad Mustafa. The three are accused of playing roles in several deadly terrorist attacks in Somalia and Kenya. U.S. Ambassador to Somalia Larry Andre, speaking in Nairobi Monday, said the new $10 million reward, double from the previous offer, will complement the Somali government's effort to defeat the Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorist group.
Today we announce the doubling of the reward offers for information leading to the capture of those leading Al-Shabaab. We also announce a new program aimed at disrupting Al-Shabaab's financial networks. Let me stress that this is in support of the announced strategy of the Somali government. So the Somali government's strategy is to contest the false religious ideology, to go after the finances, and to confront on the battlefield to liberate Somali communities.
Somali government troops and local militias are involved in a military offensive aimed at driving Al-Shabaab out of dozens of villages and towns in central Somalia. U.S. officials said arresting the Al-Shabaab leaders will disrupt the group's operations and safeguard the region's peace and prosperity. According to U.S. authorities, Ahmed Diriye, also known as Abu Ubaidah, is Al-Shabaab's top leader. He was seen in a video meeting fighters who carried out attacks at a U.S. military camp in Lamu County, Kenya, in 2020. Mahat Karate is the group's deputy leader and has at least partial command over the Aminiyat, Al-Shabaab's security and intelligence wing. Also on the list is Jihad Mustafa, a military instructor and the leader of the foreign fighters in Somalia. Mustafa, a former resident of San Diego, California, functions as an intermediary between Al-Shabaab and other terrorist organizations. The Deputy Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Kenya, Mark Dillard, said the reward covers information about illegal financial activities and businesses.
To further demonstrate our resolve to disrupt and dismantle Al-Shabaab's network, the United States, with the support of our Kenyan and regional partners, the United States is offering reward money for information that would lead to the identification and disruption of Al-Shabaab's revenue sources and funding streams. This includes information on Al-Shabaab's exploitation of local natural resources, on financial donors and facilitators, and on financial transactions.
Monday's announcement marks the first time the U.S. State Department's Rewards for Justice program has offered money for information on Al-Shabaab's financial networks. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Mohamed. As the world population touches the 8 billion mark this week, countries like India, the second most populous country in the world, are faced with the challenges from creating suitable infrastructure to creating a skilled workforce from the country's youth. Lauren Anthony of Reuters has more.
As the world's population hits the 8 billion mark, India is bursting at the seams, and it's likely to surpass China as the world's most populous country in 2023. With their already crammed transport and overcrowded public spaces, cities like the capital New Delhi and the financial hub Mumbai are struggling to cope with surging numbers of new residents. Millions arrive in New Delhi and Mumbai every year, many of whom are migrants seeking better opportunities. It's turning them into a microcosm of the country's worsening overpopulation issue. Hanikesh says taking the train in Mumbai is a safety risk. Tens of thousands of residents live in cramped slums in India, littered with dark alleys and unhygienic living conditions. Parveena Begum is a resident of Mumbai's sprawling Dharavi slum, one of the largest in the world.
This is our small house and 5-6 people live here. There is no regular supply of electricity, water, and the sewage system is bad. The sewer overflows every time, but no one cleans it, and no one collects the garbage, so we face lots of problems.
Local infrastructure is also under severe strain in New Delhi. There is no sewer in this slum and only public toilets for the 5,000 people that live there. Unemployment is also rampant across India. Thousands of candidates apply for a single post in most sectors. India's joblessness peaked at 23.5% in 2020. It's now at around 7%, higher than the global average, according to data from the Centre for Monitoring Indian Economy. India is set to surpass China as the world's most populous country in 2023, with each counting more than 1.4 billion residents this year, according to a July United Nations report. The UN anticipates that China's population will actually start shrinking from next year. In 2021, the country's fertility rate of 1.16 was below the 2.1 OECD standard for a stable population, one of the lowest in the world. Software developer Tanghua Jun says he and many of his friends are only planning to have one child due to the increasing cost of childcare. China's strict one-child policy was in place from 1980 to 2015 to keep population numbers in check. It was replaced with a two-child limit to try and stave off risks to its economy from the rapidly aging population. Then in May 2021, Beijing announced a three-child policy for married couples. China has been trying to encourage couples to have more children with tax breaks and cash handouts, as well as more generous maternity leave, medical insurance and housing subsidies. But demographers say the measures are not enough, citing factors like high education costs, low wages, notoriously long working hours and the state of the economy.
That's Lauren Anthony of Reuters.
This is Science in a Minute.
On November 10th, NASA launched a United Launch Alliance Atlas V rocket from the Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. The rocket carried the new Joint Polar Satellite System, or JPSS-2, for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA's Low Earth Orbit flight test of an inflatable decelerator, or LOFTID. The NOAA JPSS-2 and two other satellites already in polar orbit will form a fleet that will help with weather forecasting, foresee extreme weather, and keep an eye on climate change. Once the JPSS-2 reaches its final orbit in about a week after launch, NASA says the spacecraft will be renamed NOAA 21. NASA's LOFTID is a test of a new inflatable heat shield or aeroshell technology that could in the future help safely land astronauts on Mars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Protests have been growing inside and outside Iran, initially sparked by the death in police custody of Mahsa Amini, a young woman arrested by Iran's morality police for not having her hair fully covered. Each Wednesday, go beyond the breaking news with VOA's Flashpoint Iran. Listen online at voanews.com or in your podcast player. Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter.
Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hey there, it's Shauna Renee, also known as the Lady DJ, inviting you to join me every Thursday at 10 and 2200 UTC for today's hit countdown. Each week, I count down the top 20 songs in pop music according to Billboard and Rolling Stone magazines, but more importantly, according to you, the VOA listeners. Again, that's Thursdays at 10 and 2200 UTC right here on VOA 1.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of all events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinua from Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the resumption of fighting by the March 23rd Movement Armed Group, or M23, in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said in a written statement, "The resumption of hostilities since October 20th has caused significant human suffering, including deaths and injuries among civilians, and significant numbers of newly displaced persons. The United States calls for an immediate cessation of hostilities and respect for human rights and international humanitarian law." M23 is a militant group operating in eastern DRC, made up of rebels who defected from the DRC's armed forces. There are credible reports it is supported by the government of Rwanda. The M23 and some of its leaders, including Sultani Makenga, have been sanctioned by the United States and the United Nations for horrific attacks on civilians. M23 fighters recently seized multiple towns and two major roads in the DRC's North Kivu province. At least 20 civilians were killed, at least 50 were injured, and 6 peacekeepers from the United Nations Organization Stabilization Mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or MONUSCO, were injured. The offensive has displaced an estimated 475,000 people since October 20th, with another 200,000 unable to leave occupied areas. The United States calls for M23 to withdraw from its positions, disarm, and rejoin the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, Nairobi process, in preparation for disarmament, demobilization, and community reintegration offered by the government of the DRC, said State Department spokesperson Price. At a Security Council briefing, Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative of Special Affairs, called on Rwanda to cease its support for the M23 and noted that MONUSCO remains critical to bringing peace to eastern DRC and the broader region. It serves an important purpose, protecting civilians, disrupting illicit networks, and helping stabilize governance and security institutions, he said. Ambassador Wood emphasized achieving peace is contingent upon a political process, political will, and political solutions. To that end, he said, the United States announced in September an additional $30 million in funding to support a transparent electoral process in the DRC, strengthening democratic institutions, bringing justice to victims, holding bad actors to account, respecting states' territorial sovereignty and integrity, and prioritizing civilians will help bring peace to the Great Lakes. The people of the region deserve nothing less.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.